I would like to welcome to Upcoming Disc, Bruce McAllister. Bruce McAllister is a science fiction writer. He's been nominated for both the Hugo and Nebula Awards, big prestigious awards here in the science fiction community. And I want to welcome you to Upcoming Disc with the new book, Stealing God and Other Stories. How you doing, Bruce?
I'm doing great. Thanks for the invite. Thanks for the intro, Gino. Appreciate it.
Well, no, it's my pleasure. He was kind enough to send the book. I had a chance to read the book, so we'll talk a little bit about that. And there won't be any spoilers. We aren't gonna reveal any of these wonderful endings, but we will talk about some of these stories. And I guess the first thing I have to ask you is just give people a little bit of background. I notice you've been published in some prestigious magazines and other markets here in the science fiction community, and I just wanted to give us a little bit of background on your history, on your writing. Just lead us up to this book that we're going to talk about.
Oh, goodness. I've been writing and publishing over half a century, so it's a testimony to persistence. I'm mainly a short story writer, and you have to, if that's what you are, that's what your passion is, and you're not a novelist, you have to acknowledge that at some point. It's difficult to have at least a high profile career in fiction if you don't do novels, but I've led a pretty magical life as a short story writer.
Great.
And there are, of course, exceptions like Harlan Ellison, Howard Waldrop, Ray Bradbury, and others.
Yes.
Short story writers. But it is a little more difficult, but you make peace with that at a certain point. And the rule with writing fiction, is you do write the very best you can and get it out into the world. And I don't want to sound too new agey here, but it does make magic. I mean, I've had things, you write a good story, it will resonate with people, and you have no idea with whom it will resonate, and something can happen 50 years later. I mean, it's just crazy. But it's good. So I started at a very young age. I wrote my first published story at 16. It was published in a great science fiction writer, Fred Pohl's magazine for up-and-coming science fiction writers. It was called If, and then it was reprinted in the Year's Best Science Fiction, edited by Judy Merrill. And then, some years after that, Isaac Asimov praised it as one of, I can't believe, it's one of those things you go, what? How did I win this lotto?
Yeah.
It is one of the great science fiction stories. Good Lord. A little young to be getting that, because of course I didn't know what it all meant, and I had to. I remember telling people, I think the muse has tricked me, because with that beginning, I then had to write another 15 stories before I sold with other ones. So the muse, male or female, managed to get me.
Yeah.
And but as I told you before we started the interview, writers have to write for a reason, and it isn't. It's not money.
No.
I've had people say, oh, I just write for the money, and then you find out that you're getting $2,000 a novel. No, you're not writing just for the money.
No, you're not.
Because the money's not great unless after 15 years you become a best-selling writer, and even as a short story writer, it's not regular. I mean, you can suddenly get quite a bit of money.
Yeah.
Whatever that means. Not 1% money, but suddenly get it, but it's not a regular income. So most short story writers, whoever they are, in whatever genre, have day jobs as well. And I was in university teaching for 20-plus years, and since then, late 90s, I've been a writing coach and a publishing consultant and a Hollywood kind of writer consultant.
Yeah.
And so that's my day job, and sometimes one of the lines I remember growing up with was, if you want to be a writer, don't take a job involved with writing. And that's kind of true, because it can be satisfying enough, even coaching, helping, kind of rewriting work to show younger writers how to do it. That can bleed off a little bit of the writing, what should we call it, activity. So sometimes it's hard to get back to one's own writing, but the doctor's in and not taking his own advice, which is write daily, and I have a hard time doing that. It's my fault. What can I say?
Well, that's hard these days.
So, go ahead.
I said that was hard. That's hard these days to write every day. It's very difficult to do that.
It's difficult, but a lot of the work I do in coaching, and I'm not pitching my coaching here, this is my life, is a kind of intervention. And the intervention is between the writer's little self, which tends to be the tribal voice, the doubting voice, this worth doing, all of it, and that can get really insane for some people.
Sure.
Where it makes no sense what this inner, we'll call it little self, but we'll call it evolutionary ego, the protective, defensive one, where it needs to know absolutely everything in advance or it will not do it, which is just not what the greater psyche is about. And so a lot of those things get in the way, and one of the reasons we are, as writers, supposed to write daily is to get that voice over time to shut up. In other words, to substitute for its nagging monkey chatter, to substitute a habit, a good habit.
Right.
So one sense, as a coach, I see getting people to write, if they have a hard time writing daily or being productive, getting them on the wagon and staying on the wagon. Well, the wagon in this case isn't being alcohol-free, it's simply writing daily,
right,
not being so self-doubting.
Yeah.
So anyway, back to answer your question, but not going on too long about it. So I wrote in college, continued to publish, entered academia, and I was at a university where genre publications, science fiction, fantasy, were recognized. In graduate school, they were not, and I learned the first night that I needed to write experimental literary fiction to get through it. But those days have changed. MFA programs and creative writing and graduate programs are much more open to genre writing today.
Sure.
And partly that's because literary fiction today borrows so much from genre writing.
It does.
Tropes.
It really does. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it needed to do that to stay alive. But I think societally, culturally, popular culture, it's a matter of literary fiction, genre fiction is pretty literal and linear. Well, that's coming from visual media.
Right.
And so then figure everybody, even literary people, literary fiction readers, are exposed to games and graphic novels and TV and film and those, and a lot of fantasy, a lot of speculative fiction elements. Yeah, that's what they're going to write, and that's what they're going to want to write. So
yeah,
it's definitely a different era, and it's good. It's good, a good era for writers.
Yeah, I think you're right. So what about the selection process for Stealing God and Other Stories? These stories did appear in various publications over a large span of years. So tell me how you chose what you were going to put in this book.
Well, my first collection back in, I think it was 2007, was supposedly career-spanning, and that meant everything up to that point.
Right.
Could be considered, but it was all, except for one very short story, was all science fiction. And a lot of what I've been doing in the new millennium is fantasy and even some horror. And horror is simply, when it's speculative horror, fantastic, it's simply a kind of fantasy, but so is science fiction, yada, yada. So I talked to my editor at this small, wonderful small press called Eon. It's in Dublin. He's a wonderful editor, and I kind of put it on him. I sent him all what I thought were my best stories from the new millennium.
Okay.
All of the stories in Stealing God are back to the year 2000. And he said, yeah, let's do not just all science fiction, all fantasy, all horror, but do a mix. And that can be problematic. I mean, there are lots of readers out there who would like all horror, or would like all science fiction, but that's not who I am. And so he said, no, let's not do that. And he said, because your best stories, Bruce, are in all three genres. So they're all from the new millennium, and they're a mix of genre.
Yeah.
And he's a fantastic editor. I mean, just an amazing guy named John Kenny. And he was also the editor on my last little novel, which, of course, was a novel based on linked stories. I mean, there's a kind of through line plot to it, but not in the normal novel.
Okay.
And they do beautiful little trade paperbacks. And let me see, what else? The critic and prolific novelist Paul DiFilippo wrote the introduction, and
yes,
my editors in the field were kind enough to provide supportive endorsements. And he also got cover art by an award-winning illustrator by the name of Dominic Harmon. So I'm very happy with the book. But it's not whiny. I just want kind of new writers in general to know that you can write short stories. Yes, you can learn a certain amount about novel craft from short stories, but then certain other things you can't learn from short stories or novels. But be aware that that's a separate world. There are like 5,000 magazines listed at this website called Duotrope. And if you write a good short story, it will probably be published.
Mm-hmm.
Does the same apply to novels? No.
No.
There were 800,000 self-published books last year.
That's a lot.
Many, many of them, thousands of them, would have been published by a legacy, a traditional publisher in another time. So that's it. And they're all competing, of course, with digital promotional attention.
Sure.
It's a lot of white noise. So in one sense, I've offered over the years workshops called, Why Short Story Writers are so Very Happy. And it's, in one sense, because they are free of that white noise world. It's just deadly. It was easier to promote a book 15 years ago through social media than it is, effectively, than it is today.
Right.
And short story, and also publishers are impressed. You've had short stories published before, and
Reaching
a novel, or you've written a manuscript, a novel manuscript. So there are lots of reasons short story writers can be happy. Also, if you're a novelist, you can get awfully trapped inside a novel and go, I can't stand this anymore. So then you've got the self-medication, self-therapy of a short story.
Yeah.
My second novel, which took 15 years to research, and the story behind it may be more interesting than the fantastic ESP and war story of the novel itself. Who knows? People have suggested that 15 years trying to find out the truth of the Vietnam War from both extreme right and extreme left. Yes, there were moments when I probably should have died. The novel I was happy with. I interviewed 200 veterans of three different American wars, men and women, and barefoot grunts from West Virginia all the way up through ex-CIA directors. That's the point of this. So that was my second novel. It was based on a short story. The short story got quite a bit of attention in the science fiction field, and of course a couple of publishers said, is there a novel here?
Right.
So again, short stories are hard if you're not a regular producer of novels to create a career from, but at the same time, it can be a very happy thing. Also, you can imagine in the same amount of time and energy that you write a novel, imagine the possibilities for short stories, visions, voices, worlds, characters. You can access more of your own psyche in that same amount of time than you can possibly do in a novel. Novel is pretty focused.
Yeah, you're right. Well, on these stories, you've been talking a lot about the craft of writing, and of course, one of the things that writers are told is write what you know. A little harder when you're writing science fiction and fantasy, but I want to play a little game with you here. I have found what I appear to be some common elements across a lot of these stories, and I want to bring each of them up and ask you, is this something that's part of you, as part of your life? Because they seem to show up a lot. How about that? You ready?
Yeah, sure am.
Stamp collecting.
I collected, yes. But I'm going to destroy your question.
Okay.
Revealing a truth here. Ask almost any career writer who's been a science fiction or fantasy writer who's been doing it for, and that means Stephen Kuhn, Stephen King, genre people, that are known just within the field but have a major reputation.
Uh-huh.
Ask anyone who's been writing long enough, and they will say, the stuff I write even the starships, even the trolls, are more autobiographical than you, dear reader, can possibly know.
And I get that, and I, like I said, I think I found some of those elements, and certainly stamp collecting. Another one was military families. A lot of your characters were moving about part of military families.
Okay, I'm a Navy brat. My father was career, Annapolis, Pearl Harbor, NATO classified under some anti-submarine warfare guy.
Yeah.
And more a very gentle man, not a Cold War warrior at all. And so we were stationed in Italy, and that's where a number of the stories take place.
Yep, that was my next one.
Yeah, there we go. Some of the stories, and I'm not sure I'm supposed to say this because I don't think readers are interested in it. Sometimes they may be put off. Some of the stories, even the most horrifying,
right,
are more autobiographical than you might imagine.
Yeah, I kind of get that.
Why is that relevant? Because increasingly over the decades, I've chosen intense feelings in order to write a short story.
Sure.
Now, most writers will say, you have to write out of love. And then the answer to that is, well, I'm angry. I want to write out of love. No, if they would say it all goes back to love of what guided your love. You wouldn't be angry unless you loved something.
Right.
It was being threatened. So you have to have an intense feeling to write, or at least I do. And the autobiographical has kind of become increasingly important to me.
Yeah.
This world. So as a science fiction writer, fantasy writer, horror writer, what we have in this world, and that would be my lived life, my lived experience.
Sure.
Is important to me. In an exploration of what's alien, what's human, where we're going with AI. I mean, one of the stories, as you know, in the collection, is very far future. I mean, it's like, I don't know, 2,000 years in the future. But what's happened over time is I started out, you know, very science fiction fan-like. And
right.
My first short story was definitely far future in science fiction. My first novel was basically a stream... published novel was basically a stream of consciousness and ode to a mer-race 3,000 years in the future being attacked on its aquatic planet by alien reptiles. All right, well, that's not highly autobiographical, literally, but 1 year afterwards, I found all members of my family in it.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
I know, I see what you're saying.
To realize what writers... finally say, which is, hey, they call it autobiographical metaphor.
Yeah.
In other words, yeah, I literally did not have it as one of the people who raised me, a giant sea turtle.
Of course not.
Planet, but the voice, the feelings, the nurturing, the mentoring, oh yeah, I know who that is. So any writer will tell you that. And if they don't tell you that, sometimes then they're a different kind of writer, meaning they are closer to, I need to make a living, what do I need to write in order to make a living?
Commercial.
They do it. But yeah, I'll say that, yeah. And I tried that when I was very young. I mean, at least I had the intelligence to do it, which was I went and for about 6 months, 3 or 4 months maybe, and wrote as fast as I could and tried to sell what I wrote, and it was doomed. In other words, I'm a slow writer. I have to write out of feelings. I'm visual. I have to see it mirrored back to me to know on the page whether it's any good or not.
Sure.
And I discovered, no, I could not write for a living. And that's fine. I mean, if you can't write for a living anyway, writing short stories, but in my case, because I was a slow, polishing, careful writer, and actually in my career I've been known mainly as a writer's writer or an editor's writer. Though I've had a couple of stories, you know, connect with fans as well.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well,
shut me up.
Well, I didn't hear. What was that?
No, I just said, shut me up now. Your turn to talk.
That's okay. The last one of these common things I think we have in common, actually, and that is I noticed that you write a lot about reptiles and insects and small animals and stuff. There's a lot in nature, sea life as well. I noticed there's a lot in nature. A lot of these stories are very focused on animals and you know, somebody noticing a nuance or something in animals. So I'm assuming you were into that as especially younger. I still do that. I breed snakes as part of my living.
You do what?
I breed snakes as part of my living. So,
then you know what that's like.
I do.
It's not a simple thing. I came into this world, as you did,
yeah,
like that. I mean, there is a photograph I ran across of one of my father's slides. I am 5, I think, or 4. They can't get my first fish out of my hand. It's Key West, Florida. I caught it with my grandmother, and they couldn't get it away from me. I'm sleeping, holding on to my first fish.
Yeah.
Well, what was it like then? It was pure wonder that this thing could move and had a life and was so different.
Yes.
And you know the same feeling from snakes. And snakes are wonderful because they're so oxymoronic. I mean, it's like, wait, you know, people are afraid of this, and yet it's beautiful. You know, back and forth, back and forth.
Yeah.
I was, in fact, I lived with nature more than people for most of my childhood.
Yeah, I had that same experience. Yeah, I had the same experience, and so that's part of my thing. Is I just yesterday I was out at a school giving talks on reptiles and such. So it's a fascinating thing, even in my elder age, and I love when I see that fascination in youngsters now. And I see myself in so many of these kids, and it's scary sometimes.
And you don't, and that is the kind of wonder. I mean, if we're going to criticize the educational system, then it's not the teachers.
No, it's not.
Teachers have more sense of wonder than they're often allowed to teach by.
Yeah.
And it is wonder. And there are experimental schools in the world which simply have gone by wonder and a kind of, what is it, Montessori, is that the one where mm-hmm. it's manipulative, you know,
yeah.
small motor manipulation of things. But that's not standards. That's not, you know, science standards if we're competing with the Soviet Union in the 50s.
Right.
I mean, it is that adult way of making kids educated.
Yeah.
And you and I, obviously, and lots of kids are, tremendous number are.
Sure.
Are driven by wonder. And that is how you learn. Learn through wonder, wondering at the universe. In fact, family friend who had been diagnosed with ADHD, I think it was ADHD.
Yeah.
Took her out to look at fossils in the canyon here. She was mesmerized, full of wonder, and exhibited no symptoms of that alleged disorder, and went on to write an award-winning research project for her class.
Yeah.
Oops. In other words, what is maybe a lot of the ADHD, the focus problems, are about chaos, white noise.
Yeah.
Feeling powerless, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Both my wife and I might have been, not extreme cases, but might have been diagnosed as ADHD. Well, in those days, it was up to you to negotiate with the universe.
Right.
Right. To negotiate a life in which you could be who you were. Neither of us can sit in a classroom.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I would have been diagnosed. I'd have been on Ritalin or something, because I would have been what they called, in those days, they called you just restless or hyper or, you know, something like that. But today, they just drug you up.
But it allowed you to find a way, and you did. Look what you did.
And we did. And you know what? I think in those days, it was easier to do that, because there wasn't as much, as you say, white noise in the world and trying to conform you as much. I think I grew up in a time that was less into conformity.
Well, it can get fairly tragic, too. It's a little bit like GPs, general practitioners prescribing
yes.
Psychoactive medication to children. My son and his wife were told by a school counselor, you'd better get your daughter, your young daughter, assessed because there's a good chance she's blank and blank.
Right.
They talked to an older counselor, not at the school, who watched their daughter and said she is developing normally.
Yeah. That's good. I know. I think you're right in that.
We're all getting labeled, and then what happens, and we see it in social media, we see it in some of the movements. The movements all make sense. The social movements today are all about affirmation of the individual,
right,
recognition of lived life. They all make sense, but you start to see identification with the diagnosis. I am my wound. I am
right.
The diagnosis. That we don't want to see, there, because people are more than that.
Right.
More.
That's true.
Oh, yes, yay, reptiles.
Yeah. And you know what else I saw in a lot of your characters? It plugs into what we were just saying, and that is your characters are filled with wonder. Most of these stories are told from a perspective of observation, of somebody noticing nuances around them or noticing changes or noticing something happening around them that the rest of the world isn't as in tune to. And so I can see that idea that you have playing out in a lot of these characters, because that's what I see. Most of these stories, I was taken on a journey inside the mind of a character and making these observations. And there's a lot of observational moments in these stories.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of it, but wonder does play. I mean, I knew wonder played a role in the stories, but not. I'm seeing now, kind of tracking back through the stories, what you're saying. And that's true. It is observing with wonder, and that's how I came into the world. And I believe there's a wonderful line, again, from a mentor years ago, and it was Bruce, and I probably was just coming out of high school, and said, in high school, as soon as you have a thought about the group, you are no longer in the group, you are an outsider.
An observer.
Yes, you are an observer, and you have now lost membership in the group. And he said, welcome to writing, filmmaking, painting, the arts.
Art.
Another, you're another, capital O, right?
Yeah. But, I mean, you there's an extensive amount of that happening, and not just the wonder, not just that, but it's that wonder that becomes the salvation. It's that wonder that allows these characters to notice these nuances and to notice the things that are important and the really guts of the story. We wouldn't have even heard the story if not for this person's wonder and that observation and the fact that they are now in tune with these nuances they see.
That's a wonderful point. Again, I hadn't thought of that, but that's true. But I also believe, and it may seem self-absorbed, self-centered, and, you know, my imposition of what I believe, but there is a lot of strange stuff going on in the world. I call it magic. I call it miracle. It's all wondrous stuff. I mean, it is actually happening, and little self doesn't, I don't think, allows people to see it because it's neither saving their bottoms, right?
Right.
Nor killing them, right? Meaning little self is after, tries to scan the world it lives in for either promise of something or that has even monetary, some kind of value.
Right.
Or it's threat. Meaning that's our scanning mechanism run by by little self, by the evolutionary ego. And no, my brother and I, because our father was stationed there, we lived in this Italian fishing village that was indeed magical. Thinking, this is not my imagination. So when I say something that someone else may find magical realism, a lot of that magical realism actually happened.
Yeah, and you know what? The way you present it also, and I think when we talk about these autobiographical things, I think all that in the wonder and stuff, all that puts it together to create the atmosphere that allows one to really be in tune with what you're saying, that allows one to take all this and to accept it. You know, I can't explain it quite honestly, but I found that because of the wonder and because of the observations, because we were in the minds of these youngsters and what they are observing and the magic that was happening around them, I bought into it and I didn't question it quite so much as I might have because of that ability you have of creating these senses from these characters.
Well, thank you, and that is, of course, we'll call it the benign manipulation of fiction, which is it tells the truth in very uncanny, indirect, even paradoxical ways. So yeah, if I were to say to someone, try to tell them in nonfiction, writing a piece of nonfiction, or
right.
just telling them how magical that fishing village was with its witches, and were they witches? Well, the kids viewed them as witches.
Sure.
Poisoned the neighbor's cats. Our teacher was a hunchback with a lisp and very mm-hmm. saintly. And in the novel I wrote, the one I mentioned to you,
yeah.
collection of linked stories, I have him disappear. No one knows what happened to them. Well, a couple of years ago, I made contact with the same teacher teaching in the same room that I was in.
Nice.
So, 40 years later, and he looked for the man, and he could not find him. He said, there is no record of that teacher.
Oh, no.
You can't tell me they use magic. But what I've discovered is, you know, some people, they came into this life one way, I came in another way, but there's mm-hmm. a tremendous amount of wonder. And as you know, in the animal world, in nature, it's just amazing. And any issue of Science News is fascinating. It's like, just discovered that bees actually play with each other.
Right.
You know? I mean, it's just like, it's science fiction. I think 30 years ago, I had a friend say, I don't want to write science fiction anymore. Anything I can come up with is trumped by a single issue of science.
Sure.
Of Science News.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. I mean, so this ongoing thing where we're finding out not just tools, but the ability to play among animals.
Right.
But you would have seen that with reptiles.
Exactly.
When my son was really young, I got him we caught an alligator lizard, and we fed the alligator lizard a couple of different things. And when it was a cockroach, it approached the cockroach in a different way.
Right.
It did kind of dance. When it did not like earwigs, because the earwig would bite it in the eye, when it approached moths, there was a different dance and a way depending on the prey.
Yeah, it was communicating.
I've been reading for years. I knew this wasn't in the literature, and I approached a herpetologist, and you could tell that that wasn't where science was. Animal behavior was not where science was at that point.
Yeah.
Sometimes all these kind of 19th century naturalists rather than PhDs in molecular chemistry.
Right.
You know, to appreciate nature.
Yeah. Another thing I found about your characters and these stories, another common theme was that many of these characters were like the right person at the right time. There's a lot of these characters where this character was the only one who could have been, you know, have done this change the way it happened.
That's fascinating, but like, you're right. That's true.
And the other thing I enjoyed about these stories, too, is that while some of them they take place during an historic event, like the Cuban Missile Crisis, most of them, because you seem to, and I'm hoping it's deliberately, you seem to stay away from the trappings of a particular time period, cell phones and televisions and such like that so much, so that these stories, no matter when they were published, they worked for today. You didn't tie them as much as some people do into a time. And I realize science fiction, you know, this is future stuff and people do that. But you made it so this could have happened in the past. It could have happened in the future. It could have been happening now. And I don't know if that was a deliberate attempt, but I found that to make the stories much more enjoyable.
Well, thank you. That's good to hear that. And it was still, it's kind of unconsciously deliberate. I don't believe in the importance of those. Of, you know, the digital things, the tech things. I, you know, believe, I guess, in the importance of, you know, human spirit and human beings. So, yeah, I mean, was it intentional? It was intentional in one sense, even if it was unconscious.
Right, but that is timeless, this idea, the importance of human beings and this stuff.
It's really good to hear, because as we know, Hollywood, film and TV, things can date very quickly, but it's fascinating to see Hollywood, how they will intentionally set something in a pre-cell phone era. It's like, we don't want to deal with cell phones. We don't want to deal with this other stuff. And they could, but it often in a film changes things immensely. Back in the day, when I had a Hollywood mentor, Uncle Milty Gelman, he was a Western writer.
And yeah.
Actually, ten fathers of the golden age of television. Just really down-to-earth guys. And he said, oh, yeah, you don't have people use the phone. Then they can't confront each other. So even though they could use the phone, you have them going to the other person's apartment to scream at them.
Right. Because that's better drama. I had a writer tell me that cell phones were the worst thing for drama because now you can't. It's harder to have this moment where you can't get a hold of somebody that needs to have information, you know, and is driving into a disaster or something. Now you just call them on their cell phone.
Well, yeah, and of course, then what Hollywood does, which is just hilarious, is if you extrapolated from Hollywood film and TV, using the number of locations where you can't get cell phone reception,
right.
Would be like 90% of you, like we couldn't function.
Yeah.
But that's the only thing they can deal with it. Otherwise, it would be 911. Okay, we'll be there in 5 minutes.
Exactly.
No story, no plot, you know?
Yeah. That's absolutely true. I also like the emotional connection in these stories. There's a lot of father and son connections in these stories, and I kind of really connected to that a little bit myself. And so it's these human emotions. The fact that you concentrated more on the humanity of the stories and less on technology and less on, you know, some super duper thing, I think really will keep these stories that someone can read them 50 years from now, and they'll be just as appropriate and just as, you know, relative then.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. Thanks, Gino. Appreciate it.
I do have another question for you. I also see running through these, there's a couple times where, of course, aliens are trying to either secretly or in some way help us. I'm wondering if you subscribe to the ancient astronaut theory.
The first novel I wrote at 14 was all of human history, going all the way back to the beginning and all the way into the future.
Yeah.
14-year-olds do. And in that one, I used a von Däniken idea. I was before I knew anything about von Däniken.
Right.
Basically, it was aliens or what we see rendered on cave walls, you know, that kind of idea, which has been done to death.
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. It's a little bit like conspiracy theory. It's probably not as neat as we think it is. In other words, in all those 15 years spent on my novel, Dream Baby, well, a lot of it was, it taught me a lot about conspiracy theory. And
right.
usually people, conspiracy theories for people who believe in them, those theories, it doesn't matter whether they're rational or not, they're serving another purpose. It's called psychodynamic need.
Yes.
For the individual. So engaging them is irrational, doesn't make any sense. But the CIA doesn't get along with the DOD, and during the Vietnam War set the DOD up the DIA a number of times. And it was just like, they can't, especially in America, with all of these agencies and their money and circles within circles, they couldn't possibly get together. Now, bedfellows are another matter, and crimes of opportunity are another matter. So it's a little bit like that with aliens, you know, aliens coming to probe, aliens
right.
coming to help. But I'm a firm, as a lay scientist, I have certain beliefs. Like, I don't believe that all invasive species are bad. I don't believe there's any such thing as a pristine environment.
Right.
It's only pristine for human lifespans, meaning here we are and
yeah.
we view what we see in the environment as pristine. Oh, no. If we weren't around, it would be constantly changing.
Exactly. And that comes through.
What'd you say?
I said that comes through. What you're saying right now comes through very clearly in the stories.
The thing is, I do believe that scientific, as you would call it, rather heretical, but I mean, supported by science, but I'm not a PhD in science.
Sure.
And I'm not a science fiction writer,
yeah.
that I do get that through the human and through boys and, you know, their sense of wonder and things like that. And so, for me, it's like saying that Area 51, the reality is, I'm not saying this isn't true, but I'm saying versus conspiracy theory, the reality would probably be something closer to, yes, please think it's alien.
Right.
Because it's actually experimental craft that we don't want the Soviets to know about. This is wonderfully deflected. see what I'm getting
at? Yeah, I see what you're getting.
That's what brings it down to the human. And actually, assassinations of people, I over those 15 years, came to find out about things that, how to put it, I shouldn't know.
Right.
As a fiction writer, I'm not a threat anymore. I'm not going to release the Pentagon papers.
Right, exactly. You're not out there to make that kind of a point.
All of that tells me that we need to apply at least that kind of thinking to aliens.
Right.
And then you've got, even among astronomers, you know, notions, well, wait, what are the chances of our connecting with them at a certain time of our civilization and theirs? You know, all sorts of ideas like that. So I did a lot of ESP research for that novel.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're writing a novel, you don't have to necessarily believe in ESP.
Well, of course not.
Using it as a story. And it was in this novel, it was a metaphor for the specialness of these veterans, meaning the human specialness.
Right.
It was a metaphor. But by the end of the 15 years, I was a believer because I had interviewed so many. They were not. Those 200 vets didn't really care whether I believed it or not. They were just happy to have someone who was interested in their story.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely get that.
Any number of spoon-bending types who really wanted me to believe, and they were the least convincing.
Right.
In other words, the one you want to talk to about UFOs, the policeman who saw one and doesn't want to talk to you.
Exactly. The one who's eager to talk to you is the one less to believe. I'm with that as well.
And so what it was is, I mean, all of that experience covering a couple of wars in Southeast Asia, and there were categories of ESP, of the paranormal, that they felt helped save their lives. It was mightily convincing. Well, the problem with that is that's called anecdotal. You cannot replicate it in a lab.
Exactly.
A mother dreaming the death in detail of her son 10,000 miles away in a war, which is infinitely more common than people imagine, you can't replicate it in a lab. You can't control human psyche to make that happen.
Yeah.
And so it is out of interest to science, but I didn't know how heavy a weight the anecdotal evidence for any number of things.
Right.
You know?
I definitely get that.
So the same thing to me applies. It's like it's a little bit like ghosts. Hollywood ghosts are supposed to be scary.
Yeah.
Well, who says so? It's kind of like they don't have to be scary if there's a ghost. In other words, we project. It's like the devilfish, the manta ray.
Yeah.
Was labeled evil down in the Gulf of Mexico. And that's a projection. It's a little bit like McCarthyism, right? It's a projection.
Yeah.
You know, there's something you have labeled bad inside yourself, but you can't live with yourself. You project it on witches in a burn and on communists, godlessness, and whatever else.
Yeah.
So I'm sure we're doing that. Who knows? I have no idea. But the evidence means. I mean, no way of knowing, but I do know that human beings love to manage a thing by language, by notion, by idea, and that human beings project a lot too.
Yeah, I think you're right. So let me ask you one last question here. Do we have anything else coming from you anytime soon? Is there something that people should be looking for?
Well, this is my punctuation mark to make it even more relevant, I think, to what you do. That Vietnam novel, I didn't serve, full backstory, I didn't serve in Vietnam.
Right.
I like half of my generation or whatever. But then in the early 70s, I started meeting that other half who'd gone in my stead.
Sure.
And I started feeling survivor's guilt and also felt some little bit of outrage over the fact that both Hawks and Doves were lying to us or out of ignorance, if nothing else.
Right.
So I wanted to know Vietnam War had really been about, and I wanted to address the survivor's guilt. Well, after 15 years, both happened.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you exactly what happened in the Vietnam War, and what's strange about it is the split in our nation was simply from the telling of an original American cultural myth, and by that, speaking anthropologically. I mean, a story we tell ourselves to know who we are,
right,
where we have been, where we're going in the universe. It doesn't mean a lie.
Right.
And that was the story of a common man being oppressed by an oppressor. So King George and the colonists.
Yep.
So the Hawks viewed the communist as the oppressor and the South Vietnamese as the oppressed.
Right.
And Fonda Dove viewed us as the oppressor. And do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, it's a point of view.
It was pretty simple. And the weird thing was the French already knew all of this, but JFK met with Charles de Gaulle. And when
right.
de Gaulle said, you know, look what happened to us, JFK actually said more arrogantly than we think of him as being, we're not you.
Yeah. And that's what everybody thinks.
Yeah, exactly. And that's that arrogance. It gets every country into trouble.
Yeah.
So that satisfied that. Well, the novel was published in 1990. I consult in kind of story. I'm a good story consultant with TV and film with individual writers. Writers
right.
approach me on my my former students who've gone into TV and screenwriting.
Yeah.
So I approach and I know when there's a bad contract and when there's a good one, and then if it's too complicated, I say, you got to go talk to one of the three kinds of, you know, reps. Don't
right.
talk to me about this. I have learned more about Hollywood by Dream Baby not having been optioned or purchased or made
yeah.
than I ever would have otherwise. The people really interested in it have ranged, I don't even know, so we're talking about 30 years.
Yeah.
Madonna, Ron Howard, Helen Hunt, I can't even keep track. Ridley Scott, Jorge Saralegui, a producer,
right.
sci-fi chef, everybody, and everyone had a different vision for it, which leads to William Goldman's line, nobody knows a thing in this town.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now it looks like, I'm not going to bore you with details on this, but my son and two of his magical friends, speaking of magic, these are very magical people.
Yeah.
I formed a production company, which is very odd because we're not producers.
Right.
So we get looked at strangely but taken seriously.
Well, good.
And we now have a really good pitch deck for a highly morphed version of that novel. So we have access at the VP level and maybe higher at some of the streaming companies, but
right.
the streaming companies are now, as you probably know, in a bloodbath.
Oh, yeah.
So we are told not to approach. Please don't approach me. Please don't. You know, you will die. I will die, and then you'll be orphaned, that kind of line.
Yeah.
Until February. It's a wonderful thing, and it was wonderful because we had, right before COVID, two managers at one of the five biggest management companies in Hollywood help us develop it. So it's already been developed.
Oh, good.
And fortunately, it hadn't launched, meaning what couldn't go into development hell, it couldn't, it wasn't an option. It hadn't really launched before COVID because that would have killed it.
Right.
As we know, all the Hollywood projects that are dead. And I'm talking not non-lethal. Here.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean, yeah.
So we're looking forward to it. I really enjoy that kind of writing. We've got some other projects based on some short stories of mine.
Great.
In the pipeline, and I like that. So if there's something coming that may be coming in a year or two, and...
And where can people find you so that they can keep an eye on what you're doing and know when these things are coming up? Is there a website or something that these people can get to?
Well, I've got a coaching website, and that's just mcallistercoaching.com.
Okay.
But in terms of other things, no, I just guess Google me. Right. I don't have much of a social media presence. I've got, they want to friend me on Facebook, but then they have to put up with a lot of grandchildren pictures.
Yeah, I get that.
Professional stuff.
Then you'll have to let us know, and we'll make sure we spread the word.
All right, good. And hey, people, there's an email an email form on my website. People can contact me through that as well, and I always answer email.
Well, good. Well, I have to tell you, I am so honored and gratified that you spent the time with us today to talk about your book and to talk about writing and such. I found it enjoyable because, again, reading your book, there were things that took me back to my childhood. So that was kind of it became kind of a personal thing for me, which, you know, doesn't happen that often. So take that as a good compliment.
Well, thank you, Gino, and again, thanks for the invite and for reading the book.
I hope people do. It's out there, and we'll certainly there'll be an Amazon link on the podcast page, so people will be able to get it, and we'll make sure we get that website for you out there as well. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for the invite again.